John Urbick versus the Spencer Law Firm.
May it please the court, my name is Gene Boland. I represent the debtor, John Urbick, and the bankruptcy trustee. I was appointed as special counsel by the bankruptcy court. This case involves...
Can you reserve any time, counsel?
Yes, please. 4 minutes, Your Honor. This case arises from an egregious period of representation, about 8 months, during which a bankruptcy lawyer, or at least a lawyer who held himself out as a bankruptcy lawyer in Tacoma, did virtually nothing for 8 months, resulting in a little more than $1 million of Mr. Urbick's lifetime assets that he had acquired as a wage earner. The bankruptcy, which he was eventually required to file, involved a discharge of only, I believe, $407,000 in debt. So he lost more than twice the value of his debt in the representation that he was provided by.
Why does any of that matter to the issue before us?
I think it does, because we're talking about a wage earner's lifetime assets. We're talking about
judicial estoppel, and judicial estoppel is a doctrine not designed to protect either party, but to protect the integrity of the judicial process. So why does the merits of what did or didn't happen to your client have any bearing on whether the doctrine applies?
That's true, but I can't cite authority for this, but in my view of the law, the amount of the damage and the loss caused to a party in a lawsuit like this has to do with the degree of carefulness that we should look at the claims. He lost everything.
How do you reconcile that with the oft-repeated statement that judicial estoppel is not intended to protect the interests of either party?
Well, judicial estoppel is, to begin with, judicial estoppel is, I can't resolve that.
And maybe you should move on to the legal arguments.
I will. Mr. Urbick did everything he should have done in this.
Did he disclose his claim on his list of assets when he filed his bankruptcy?
Not when he filed it in the first instance.
Did he mention it at the first meeting of creditors?
No, he was unaware of it.
Did he mention it within a year after filing his first set of schedules?
No, but he has...
Did he mention it before he got his discharge from bankruptcy?
No. He was unaware of it.
So how... He was unaware of the fact that he had a malpractice claim?
Yes.
What facts did he learn, as disclosed in the record before us, during the 2 years before he sought relief from the bankruptcy court that he was unaware of on the day he filed his petition?
Mr. Urbick is a wage earner, and there is... legal malpractice actions are sophisticated causes of action, very sophisticated.
I'm asking you for something a little simpler. What facts did he become aware of when he filed, before he filed his motion to amend his schedules that he was unaware of at the time he filed his petition for bankruptcy?
All I can tell you is that he, in the record, is his declaration stating that he was unaware that he had the claim, and I think the record suggests that he was also unaware of the interplay between the bankruptcy proceeding and his potential civil claim against Mr. Spencer. So I can't find a case, and not one has been cited by the other side, where judicial estoppel applies under the facts of this case, where the plaintiff is discharged in bankruptcy, but then reopens the bankruptcy when he discovers he has a civil cause of action, and he amends his schedule before filing suit. And that's exactly what occurred here. So he filed the suit against Mr. Spencer only after having done that. I think what this case is really about is the way the court relied on a false declaration filed by the defense attorney providing a false record of the case, and that was what...
What is the false fact in the defense filing that you're referencing?
The false fact is that defense counsel filed a declaration which attached approximately 38 pages of the bankruptcy file, and defense counsel said it was a true and accurate copy of the bankruptcy record. In fact, the bankruptcy record that he attached was 20 months old, at least 20 months old, and was not a current record.
Was it a record of everything that occurred before discharge?
Everything that occurred before, but not after, correct.
So it was everything that the trial or the bankruptcy court could have relied upon in deciding whether or not to grant the discharge?
In the first instance, correct.
Okay, well, it only granted a discharge in one instance, right?
Well, correct, but the bankruptcy matter is still open pending the outcome of this appeal, and I imagine there will be further action by the bankruptcy court at some point. So judicial estoppel is a receding doctrine in the United States, and Washington is following that trend by, and it's evident from Arkeson, the Arkeson versus Ethan Allen case, which is one of the cases that both of us rely on. As a matter of fact, the defense claims that it's dispositive, and I think I would probably agree. And in that case, judicial estoppel was held not to apply to trustees in bankruptcy, and we believe that the court should have denied the motion for summary judgment and additionally given the plaintiff 10 days within which to add the trustee as an additional party.
Was there ever a motion filed in the trial court to join the trustee as a party plaintiff?
No, because only judicial estoppel was added. That was the sole basis of the motion for summary judgment. Seven additional claims were added in the reply in the trial court, including that the trustee had not been named as a plaintiff. We were prejudiced by that.
All right, thank you. You have 4 minutes.
May it please the court, Richard Rowland for the defendants and respondents, Spencer and the Spencer firm. I'd like to briefly address the one comment that was made by counsel with respect to my declaration in the underlying summary judgment motion. And simply for your edification, if you go to the clerk's papers at page 107, you'll see exactly what he's talking about. And insofar as his comments were made here today, for the most part, they were inaccurate. I think that the argument that he's making here is a red herring and misconstrued, but the facts of the declaration are that I simply attached an exhibit which consisted of parts of the bankruptcy court's schedules, asset schedules to be specific, and frankly, if you go to the paragraph that's cited, you'll find that I gave a complete description of what was there. There was no intent to represent the entire bankruptcy file. It was intended to authenticate in a declaration a pleading from the court that was also presented to the trial court as part of a request for judicial notice. So that should dispose of that. I think that with respect to the substance of the appeal here, you, in reviewing the actions of the trial court, probably should look at two significant issues. Number one is what the standard of review is here. Standard of review for application of judicial estoppel by a trial court is whether or not the trial court judge undertook an abuse of discretion.
This is a summary judgment?
Yes, sir. Yes, Judge.
Why isn't it de novo then?
Well, you're entitled to look at the facts de novo, but you also have to determine whether the trial judge's application of those facts is an abuse of discretion. That's the holding in any number of judicial estoppel cases in Washington and, frankly, in the federal courts. The federal court laws are designed...
The federal court has a different summary judgment standard, so that's not going to be real helpful.
That's just what I was going to say. The Washington cases note that Washington law will apply to the determination of whether the application of judicial estoppel is appropriate, and federal cases with respect to bankruptcy are informative and should assist the court. And that's a definitive statement that's made, I think, in Miller v. Campbell. But at any rate, the standard of review here is abuse of discretion. And a second thing that bears on that, if the court, and I'm sure you've all read the file, if the court has read the file, the opposition to the motion on summary judgment below consisted of 9 pages. There were 4 pages of legal argument and some string cites of authority without analysis. There were 3 short declarations, one by the plaintiff, one by the bankruptcy trustee, and one by plaintiff's counsel. of significance, the plaintiff's declaration essentially did nothing more than state what counsel has said already here today, and that is that he just didn't know he had a cause of action.
What length of time transpired between the filing of the answer with the affirmative defense of judicial estoppel and the entry of the summary judgment order by Judge Kaufman?
I'd say 8 to 9 months.
And there was more than the usual 30 days between the filing of the motion for summary judgment and the entry of the order as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
And at any point during that time, was there any motion filed to substitute the trustee as plaintiff?
No, Your Honor. The court here is essentially bound by the same restrictions that the trial court was, which is to the record. And the court, in reviewing the record in opposition by the plaintiff as well as the defendant's moving papers, came to a conclusion that's evidenced in the transcript of proceedings, which is available to the court. And just informatively, that record of proceedings was also included in a subsequent motion for reconsideration. So it's not a standalone document. I believe that the report of proceedings is found beginning at 386 in the clerk's papers. But the record of the oral argument shows that the court addressed virtually every issue that was raised by the plaintiff in his opposition, and the court ultimately came to a conclusion and a holding on the record that he believed that the fact that the plaintiff, as the plaintiff stated in his declaration, had not believed he had a claim or did not file a claim until he learned of the possibility of acquiring some personal benefit from the no-asset bankruptcy, was at least it led to a perception of misleading the bankruptcy court, if not subsequent courts. The judge made that on the record, and I think that he seemed to find it as some sort of an affront to the judicial system. So we have the standard review in the record. Our brief actually addresses most of the salient points with respect to judicial estoppel. I think with respect to this issue of the trustee's status, the court also in his decision and during oral argument addressed in great detail the status of the plaintiff. Our brief sets out the particulars of the legal representations that were made with respect to the trustee's status. And we objected at the time to the idea that somehow or other the trustee, without having made any appearance, could come in and request that the hearing be continued or deferred pending a decision on what the trustee wanted to do.
Essentially tell everyone that he would deal with the issue of the trustee as a plaintiff once a request was made to make the trustee the plaintiff?
In effect, I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor.
And since that never happened, he never dealt with that issue.
That's correct, Your Honor. So with respect to the facts concerning judicial estoppel, our brief sets them out. I'm sure the court's aware of the Arkeson elements. I think that all those elements are met by the facts that are shown in the summary judgment pleadings. I believe that Judge Culpepper fairly and within his appropriate discretion reasonably reviewed those facts and came to a reasonable conclusion. If the court were to reverse the trial court's decision here, it would have to make a decision that Judge Culpepper's decisions and conclusions were either unreasonable or that they were based on untenable grounds. Those are the legal standards for the abuse of discretion. And I'm willing to answer any other questions the bench may have with respect to our pleading.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Two things I think all lawyers should pay special care for in their practice. One is following court orders. Two is executing declarations upon which motions are supported. The motion for summary judgment, which was filed in this case by the defense, was exclusively based upon a claim that there was...
It would be better to devote your time to something other than attacking opposing counsel's declaration's character.
The The motion was based exclusively upon a claim that no amendment to the schedules had been made in the bankruptcy
counsel,
court.
I'll repeat. Attacking the character of opposing counsel here does not serve your client well. You should move on.
I'm not attacking the character. I'm attacking the motion.
To another topic if you want to use your time constructively.
All right. We didn't have the motion for summary judgment was pending for 8 weeks total, I believe, after some delay.
And why during those 8 weeks did you not make a motion to substitute the trustee as a plaintiff?
Because the sole purpose of the motion was judicial estoppel, and there was not a claim in the motion that the trustee should have been substituted. If that complaint had been made in the motion, we would have.
Case law already extant that judicial estoppel does not apply to a bankruptcy trustee.
Wasn't there already case law?
Yes.
Is that? Yes. And it's the Arkison case.
Isn't that the way to solve this problem for your client to have moved to substitute the trustee sometime during that 8 weeks?
Mr. Urbick was not focused on the appointment of the trustee. He was focused on the judicial estoppel and the pending motion for summary judgment and the error that was made in the presentation of evidence to the trial court. The reason we filed a 9-page opposition instead of a 20-page opposition was because it seemed crystal clear, and it is crystal clear from the motion, that the defense provided erroneous information upon which the entire motion was based. Only in their reply brief did they raise 7 other issues. One of them was the failure to name the trustee in the reply brief. By then, we had, I think, 3 or 4 days until the hearing. We could not have noted a motion in 3 or 4 days to substitute the trustee. But even under Arkison, the court held that it is an abuse of discretion to dismiss a case where the trustee is not named. They should simply permit the trustee to come in. It is an abuse of discretion, even if the court adopts the defendant's argument, and that is that the abuse of discretion applies. I assert that the de novo standard of review does apply in the first instance, and that is to whether judicial estoppel is even appropriate for the case. Now, once it applies, I think there may be an argument that there's an abuse of discretion standard, but de novo certainly applies as to the application in the first instance of the doctrine. And even if the abuse of discretion does apply as to the trustee, it is an abuse to dismiss the case when the trustee wants to come in. And, of course, the trustee executed a declaration saying not only is this the true and accurate copy of the court record that reflects a reopening of the case and an amendment, but also the plaintiff is moving with my support. And there are dozens of instances when trustees choose not to participate in a lawsuit. Excuse me, it could be risk, it could be expense, it could be that the trustee doesn't evaluate the case properly or doesn't think it's worth the time, in which case the debtor can proceed with the case. So it's not fatal to the case that the trustee wasn't a party at the time the court heard the motion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.